Hello and welcome to Historical Hysteria. My name is Nicholas Ward, and this is the only show that is definitely going to get me randomly searched the next time I go through an airport. Today we are delving into five law enforcement myths, which you believe thanks to TV and movies. If someone brutally murdered you tomorrow, you would have the peace of mind that the police are there for you. With over a century of forensic science and advances in police practices, they will put all the academic rigor of modern law enforcement into action, tracking down your murderer. Whether it takes them 1 year or 30, once the fuzz has your scent, it's only a matter of time, right? Today's episode, you might assume, is going to be about how easy it is to actually get away with crime, which you don't want to know, and some over-the-top social commentary about how your level of justice is directly related to your socioeconomic standing, which it is, because after all, it's not like I can touch the hard sciences of police work. Fingerprinting, blood splatter analysis, eyewitness testimony, interrogations, and DNA. These are the gold standards of police work. Right? Well, let's start with number five. Fingerprints. In 2002, US federal judge Louis Polak wrote a long opinion in United States v. Lara Plaza that expert fingerprint analysis failed the Daubert test, meeting only one criteria of admissibility as expert evidence. Not these particular fingerprints, but all fingerprint analysis. But we'll get back to Judge Polak, Plaza, and the Daubert test later. Fingerprints are one of those staples of police procedures. You know, call the lab, we've got a partial. A unique pattern, they are a unique pattern of ridges on your fingers, like DNA. It is something that is unique to you. If you are a criminal foolish enough to commit your crimes without gloves, police will dust, find your fingerprints, then nail your butt to the wall. There's just one problem with fingerprints. They might be complete BS. The first use of this unique print was the ancient Babylonians, who used fingerprints as a type of signature in their clay contracts. Fingerprinting first entered the English Empire around the 1850s as a form of identification in British India, and it wasn't until the late 19th century that people began to investigate the potential of the fingerprint for crime fighting, first proposed by Scottish doctor Henry Fowles. Nations went feral for fingerprints after this. The UK adopted fingerprint identification in 1894, and the rest of the world followed shortly. The first standardized fingerprinting identification techniques were published in 1901, and the rest is history. Methods of recovering fingerprints, like dusting for prints, became mainstays of law enforcement and pop culture's representation of law enforcement. Except look at your fingerprints right now, then grab a random passerby, pull their fingerprints to your face, and look at their fingers. Now, your fingerprints may be unique, but they are minuscule, and the differences are very, very slight. Which raises the obvious question, how did people in the days before computers successfully retrieve often damaged and incomplete fingerprints from crime scenes and match every one of hundreds of tiny lines so perfectly to criminals? Don't worry, there's a simple explanation. They didn't bother. Despite what you might expect of a dour police sergeant raising two transparent slides of fingerprints on negatives, putting them together, then peeling off his glasses and saying, "My God, they're a match!" That's not how fingerprint analysis works. Instead, an analyst would take the two examples and a magnifying glass and they pick out several minute points of similarity. It could take hours or even days, depending on the quality of the print recovered, and more importantly, what levels of scrutiny the local court system required, which I'm sure is a process that has been readily studied and vetted and put through the most rigorous academic criticism. And what's that? It hasn't faced any of that. None at all. Wait, what? Despite being employed by, let me just quickly check my notes here, every single police organization on the planet, fingerprinting, believe it or not, has had no firm research put into it. Fingerprint analysts have been historically reluctant to accept scrutiny of their work, and though some countries have strict guidelines for what is and is not admissible in court, not all countries do. In the UK, a recovered fingerprint requires 16 points of similarity. But saying that print has 16 minute points of similarity to your fingerprint is a lot less convincing than saying, "We matched the prints!" And do you see what's missing there? 100%. 100% of your print does not need to match. Now, some jurisdictions have a one dissimilarity rule. If there is one dissimilarity between two fingerprints, The fingerprint is inadmissible, but not every country requires those. And the number of points of similarity varies wildly around the world, from as little as 4 to as many as 20. Unlike your whole fingerprint, you will share a number of points of similarity with other people. So this raises some obvious questions, like how likely are your fingerprints to match another person's when you are using 4 points of similarity, or if you are using 20 points of similarity? What is the failure rate of fingerprint identification? Because it's not impossible for two people to have substantially similar fingerprints. So what are the odds of that? Anyway, on to number 4. Yeah, unfortunately, the answer law enforcement has generally given in the past is, don't worry about it. Now, let's get back to Judge Pollack and ruling fingerprints was inadmissible. Pollack heard a challenge under the Daubert standard and found fingerprints lacking. The Daubert principle is complicated, and we'll get into more details about it at the end of the episode. But very basically, it is the standard which United States judges use when assessing expert witness testimony. Pollack wrote that fingerprinting analysis had never been subjected to real scientific scrutiny, and that it had never faced proper peer review. Quote, "Fingerprint identification techniques have not been tested in a manner that could be properly characterized as scientific." End quote. 6 weeks after his ruling, he annulled his previous ruling, ruling that he had changed his mind and he now disagreed with his former ruling. Now, I am no way qualified to critique a US judge's rulings or when they do agree with themselves or don't disagree with themselves, but what I can say is that between 1999 and 2003, there were 40 challenges to the admissibility of fingerprinting under the Daubert standard, but they were all struck down, in some cases by judges like Pollack, who acknowledged there were many, many problems in fingerprint analysis. Though the cases keep getting struck down, they raise some very urgent questions, like why hasn't fingerprinting undergone peer review? Why is there no uniformity in fingerprint analysis? What is the error rate of fingerprint analysis? And also, on a side note, how qualified are judges to rule on the scientific validity of fingerprinting? Like, I don't know what soul-searching process Judge Pollack went through, but is that something he's qualified to do? He's a legal expert, not a scientist. Shouldn't those decisions be made at least in conjunction with scientists? Let me just check the Daubert standard and no. Just no. Okay, well, I'm sold. For an identification system which has been held up as the gold standard for forensic science for 100 years, second only to DNA in credibility, personally, I find the lack of scientific scrutiny a bit, terrifying. But anyway, that was all back in the dark days of technology. Everything is better now that we have amazing AI computers, right? Well, computer readings of fingerprints is significantly better, and for all those times the criminal leaves behind a perfect set of digital fingerprints, then it works fine. What's that? That's never once happened ever. Which means computers actually have to use the same basic analysis of limited identification points. Huh. And does that make computers any more infallible than human testers? Don't worry about it. Okay, let's move on to number 4, blood splatter analysis. Blood splatter is another favorite of forensic scientists in TV shows, and often in real life. Some forensic scientists say that blood splatter can recreate a crime scene almost perfectly, and tell us such vital things like distance, force, object, even height and strength of the attacker. There are 4 key characteristics of blood splatter analysis. 1. Blood will not break up unless it is acted upon. 2. Blood forms spherical shapes. 3. Surface tension causes blood to move itself horizontally and vertically. 4. The surface tension will maintain the sphere shape of the blood drop until it impacts with the surface. That is some real Nancy Drew work there. And by Nancy Drew work, I mean it sounds like it was drawn up by a 14-year-old. Like fingerprint analysts, blood splatter experts have some very, very serious questions that they are desperately trying not to answer. Questions like, is this real? Do you have any evidence for this? And are you a con man? Blood splatter first exploded onto the crime scene in the US during a murder trial in Texas in 1985, when self-declared blood splatter expert Herbert McDonald testified he was certain the defendant had murdered his family because of the blood splatter. McDonnell, to defend his expert status to the judge, produced a mirror and some of his own blood, dropping it onto the mirror and then his clothes. Despite there not being a mirror at the crime scene, the stunt had nothing to do with the case. He was just demonstrating that blood splattered on different materials differently. Something I don't think anyone was going to object to. Despite this, the judge ruled that this maniac smearing a vial of his own blood on himself seemed like an expert to him, and blood splatter and McDonald passed the Daubert test. The no doubt very frustrated defense attorney objected and appealed the case, but the subsequent challenge, instead of ending with "a man brought a vial of his own blood into your courtroom and you thought that he was credible," instead set a precedent that made blood splatter admissible evidence all over US courts. McDonnell would go on to sell training to an entire generation of conmen, I mean blood splatter experts, who must have been pretty shocked when in 2009 the National Academy of Science wrote, quote, "The uncertainties associated with bloodstain pattern analysis are enormous," end quote. Blood splatter experts were put to the ropes with impossible questions like, "How does this work?" and "What research have you really done?" Unfortunately, judges just didn't seem to care. And prosecutors loved blood splatter analysis. Blood splatter analysts had impressively high conviction rates and often helped secure convictions in cases with tenuous evidence. And like fingerprinting, people seemed to lose interest in disproving blood splatter once it became a mainstay of getting convictions. As for McDonnell, who invented this science, well, he was pretty open, at least at first, that blood splatter wasn't a science. In the foreword to his book about blood splatter, he said that blood splatter probably did not meet reasonable scientific certainty. Which I could have sworn that point one of the Daubert standard was scientific certainty. But I'm not some fancy big city lawyer or any kind of lawyer, but what? I mean, to McDonald's credit, he was refreshingly honest for a pseudoscientist, but despite this lack of scientific certainty, he went on to smear blood splatter all over the American court system. He became somewhat of a celebrity for it, and in 1973 he testified at the O.J. Simpson's trial. For the defense, naturally. You didn't think his life had a redemption arc, did you? He died in 2019 at the age of 90, despite increasing scrutiny on blood splatter and impossible questions like, "Is this real?" This circumstantial evidence is, to this day, admissible in many US court systems. Surely we all know today that circumstantial evidence is not real. If there's one thing that everyone knows, it's that circumstantial means fake. Well, that brings us to number three, circumstantial evidence and the CSI effect. A Weasley defense attorney jumping up and yelling, "That's circumstantial!" or a wizened old cop shaking his head and saying, "We can't put him away with this, it's circumstantial." Those are classics of police procedurals. Which is weird considering that's not how the law works. Despite becoming popular in shows like CSI, circumstantial evidence has long been the mainstay of police evidence. Circumstantial evidence is any evidence that relies on inference. The alternative is rock-solid direct evidence. Photographs, eyewitnesses, videos. The problem is, circumstantial evidence is the majority of evidence. Everything from fingerprints to DNA is circumstantial. All forensic evidence is circumstantial. This has actually and hilariously become a point of frustration for courts. It's called the CSI effect, and it describes juries who immediately dismiss evidence if an attorney calls it circumstantial. Look, Your Honor, yes, my client's DNA was all over the apartment. Yes, he was seen entering the apartment with the murder weapon. Yes, he had an argument with the victim. Yes, he had means, motive, and opportunity. And yes, he benefited financially from the crime. But this is all circumstantial evidence. You can't prove any of it. Yeah, that seems a bit ridiculous, doesn't it? Although, given what we just learned about blood splatter and fingerprints, maybe doubting circumstantial evidence isn't so bad. Maybe we should rely more on direct evidence, things as solid as eyewitness testimony. Which brings us to number two, eyewitness testimony. Damn it, I've got to start reading the subtitles before I write these episodes. Yeah, eyewitness testimony, as it turns out, is kind of terrible. Aside from the obvious problems like corruption and bad memory, there is a far simpler reason eyewitness testimony is falling under increasing scrutiny today. We all think of our memories as infallible, but in reality, not only are we prone to misremember things, but we might actually be able to have memories implanted in our brain. Now, I know that sounds like crazy talk, but hear me out. Experiments into implanting memories are ongoing. One of the longest term and most convincing are those of Elizabeth Loftus. Loftus has been experimenting with implanting false memories since the Nixon era. In her most famous experiment, Loftus would, in the guise of quizzing the patient's background, start by asking them questions about their past, which she already knew of, and then she would start asking about an event that hadn't happened, dropping in real details provided by the subject's parents. This was called the lost in the mall technique because the first subject was told a fictitious story about being lost in the mall as a child. She found a quarter of participants would embrace the false memories. Some even started adding details into the fictitious event. Loftus's work has led to some serious questions about the reliability of eyewitness testimony. But come on, how many cases involve rogue psychologists randomly implanting fake memories in people's heads? Well, at least in America, police are allowed to lie to you during an interrogation. And while pop culture has often presented this as kind of cute and charming, like in the sitcom Brooklyn Nine-Nine, it's a lot less cute and charming when police spend dozens of hours interrogating mentally ill people, telling them that they already have proof they committed the murder. They must have just blocked it out of their memory. That actually happened, and is completely legal. Which is, fucked. Sorry, I forgot to say opinion alert, my bad. It should be unsurprising that alongside evidence of the police gaslighting people are allegations of police essentially coaching confessions and witnesses, essentially giving people key details in cases to make their confessions or witness statements more believable. Though no firm data exists about this. And the police deny that it happens regularly and claim rogue officers who do this kind of thing get caught and punished. But emotionally torturing a mentally ill person and trying to gaslight them into confessing to a murder? That's totally fine. That's legal. So now you're expected to doubt fingerprinting, blood splatter, and eyewitness testimony. What next? Forensic science as a whole? Well, that brings us to number one. Forensic science. Okay, I probably should have put blood splatter and fingerprinting under this heading, but they really needed their own sections. Now, no, forensic science isn't pseudoscience, but over the last 100 years, it has done a remarkably good job of attracting a high number of pseudoscientists. Forensic science is a broad tent and applies to everything from DNA evidence to bite mark analysis. What the hell is bite mark analysis? And is it as ridiculous as it sounds? No, no. It's so much worse. The Innocence Project describes bite marks with the very diplomatic, "Bite mark evidence has never been validated." I imagine Kennedy Brewer, who was convicted on bite mark evidence of the rape and murder of a 3-year-old, would probably have some choicer words for bite mark evidence, because Brewer was exonerated by DNA evidence after 15 years in prison. Bite marks were essentially the only evidence against him in his trial. Though the expert who testified said he was certain the marks were Brewer's teeth, a survey of the same marks found a dozen different bite mark experts couldn't even agree that the marks on the skin were bite marks. There have been 24 cases of wrongful conviction where bite marks were used as evidence. The National Academy of Science, in the same report that called out blood splatter as unsubstantiated, was much more blunt about bite mark analysis, saying there was a substantial rate of erroneous errors. Other studies have found that bite mark analysts, when presented with possible cases of biting, have no consistent ability to determine if an injury is a bite, which, wow, that is bad. And the testimony of bite mark experts is still admissible in some courts. Now, obviously, bite mark evidence doesn't discredit all forensic science, but what it is emblematic of is a wider problem in law enforcement, the law, and how the law handles forensic science. Inherently, law enforcement considers getting a conviction as being right, which has created a market for fast-talking charlatans who can convince a jury, even on poor evidence, to convict people on what is often fairy tales. And no, that's not just me saying that. Over the last 30 years, as DNA testing has become more normalized, exonerations have skyrocketed. In fully one quarter of exonerations, the person convicted was convicted on evidence provided by expert testimony of forensic scientists. Concern has since grown about this explosion of faulty convictions. Dr. West, the bite mark analyst who testified at the trial of Kennedy Brewer, was actually suspended by the American Board of Odontology and dismissed as a quack, even by other bite mark analysts. And former members of the ABO have gone on to call out the science of bite marks as non-existent. Despite this, when it was presented as evidence to the Mississippi Supreme Court requesting a retrial of a man who we now know was innocent, the court wrote, quote, "Just because Dr. West has been wrong a lot does not mean, without something more, that he was wrong here." Which, wow, but whatever. In America, this culminated in a 2015 National Commission of Forensic Science to investigate the use of forensic science and its expert testimony in the American justice system, issuing a number of recommendations to the Department of Justice. And investigations into how law enforcement uses forensic science and how it is admissible are now taking place in court systems globally. Many court systems are taking a very careful approach to their findings. And then there is Australia, where the president of the Victorian Court of Appeal said, quote, "With the exception of DNA, no other area of forensic science has been shown to be able reliably to connect a particular sample with a particular crime scene or perpetrator," end quote. That is damning. I know it doesn't sound like much, but by legalese court standards, that is basically a mic drop moment. So, is this the end of forensic science? Despite the growing concerns about the pseudo-scientific infiltration into the justice system, most justice systems don't seem in too much of a hurry to do things about it. Since the US National Commission on Forensic Science finished in 2017, the number of forensic labs in the US has dramatically increased. And nothing has really changed. The recommendation that the commission passed to the DOJ and those the DOJ adopted were mostly just updated guidelines to be more careful. An ex-politician once told me, "It doesn't matter what they say. If there's no money and no enforcement behind it, it is not real." Meaning that after all of that, in most of the world, there is no real comprehensive review of blood splatter, fingerprinting, or even bite mark evidence. Over the last 100 years, there has evolved a belief crime could always be solved with science. This has been how forensic science has been seen in pop culture since Sherlock Holmes. How does every single crime procedural end? With the good guy laying out their picture-perfect reconstruction of events and the bad guy confessing. And public perception holds these things as fact. Fingerprinting is synonymous with infallible or irrefutable, and there is no reason to assume a judge is any more immune to this pop cultural influence than anyone else. And this idea of scientific infallibility has created a market for a whole range of pseudosciences. This problem has been compounded by a court system made up of legal experts, not scientists. In the US, the admissibility of expert witness testimony like fingerprints, blood splatter, and bite marks has to meet the Daubert standard. There's also a thing called the Fry standard, but I'm not going to get into that. The Daubert standard is a complex set of guidelines for who gets to claim to be an expert. But it basically boils down to, the judge gets to decide. Now, I'm not going to say letting legal experts be the final arbiters of expertise in science is a terrible idea, I'm just going to imply it. Now, the Daubert standard outlines a whole list of criteria to take into account. How widely accepted is this science? What is the error rate? How reliable is the expert? And how have they applied their expertise in this case? But again, all of that is down to the individual judge to decide. So, for instance, if some wild-eyed maniac bursts into a courtroom screaming about how your teeth are the fingerprints of your mouth, with no scientific certainty to back that up, well, depending on how gullible or incompetent the judge is, I mean, how easily swayed the judge is, that just becomes admissible. Obviously, step two of that process is that that conviction gets appealed. And more judges with no background in science get to decide whether that is real science or not. That can be appealed higher, but that is a very expensive and difficult process. And once an appeals court has ruled something admissible, in most Western systems, that means that you now have a precedent. And once you have a precedent, everybody suddenly has to take whatever wild theory about teeth you happen to have seriously. And if you're wondering how difficult it is to get courts to admit they made a mistake, well, I would refer you back to the Mississippi Supreme Court's "Well, he may be a con man liar whose area of expertise is basically teeth phrenology, but we're just going to assume he was right in this case." Sorry, I'm paraphrasing the original, because the original was just too offensively dumb to quote, but also is a well-established legal precedent in English common law. When and how forensic evidence is admissible in court changes in every single legal system, and I am in no way qualified to comment on the how and why of these systems in any one country, let alone all of them. So, as always, I am relying on experts in their fields. But I will add a disclaimer to this episode. The people railing against forensic evidence, who I got most of my information from, they are usually defense attorneys and legal aid charities. And there are a number of very long and very confusing legal defenses of both the Daubert principle and the admissibility of forensic law. So, extreme conjecture alert here. If we as a society came to the conclusion that some of our most effective circumstantial evidence was flawed, how would that affect the justice system? How many people would have to be retried or let go? And how difficult would it become to convict people at all? I wonder if any of these questions crossed the mind of Judge Pollack in the 6 weeks he mulled over his decision. That is all we have time for today. Thank you for joining me. Feedback can be sent to historicalhysteria@gmail.com, and don't forget to check the socials, r/historicalhysteria on Reddit and @manichistory on Twitter. But before I leave, let me leave you with this. My bad history take of the week goes to howstuffworks.com, who starts its article on bite mark analysis with, "Bite mark analysis is extremely complex," then goes on to not tell you how bite mark analysis works, which I thought was the whole point of the website, but whatever. It also does this with blood splatter and fingerprinting, while also weaving in confusing and myth-based historical claims about forensics. But what really gets the authors of How Stuff Works in trouble is the fact that a website supposedly dedicated to science, facts, and telling you how things works presents something like bite marks as an established science, without even once addressing the many, many criticisms of it. A take so bad, it will definitely condemn How Stuff Works to the dustbin of history, and what's that? 22 million visitors a month. Well, join me next week for 5 amazing sciences that are totally real. Just trust me, number 1, phrenology. Anyway, my key sources for this week are ProPublica.org, blood splatter analysis, issues.org, fingerprint evidence, the BBC, Can We Trust Forensic Science, and The Innocent Project with What Is Bite Mark Evidence? And the United States Department of Justice report on forensic science at ojp.gov. Bye.